This is BBC News from London. Buckingham Palace has announced the death of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. In a statement, the palace said the Queen died peacefully at Balmoral this afternoon. The King and the Queen Consort will remain at Balmoral this evening and will return to London tomorrow. BBC Television is broadcasting this special programme reporting the death of Her Majesty the Queen.
The announcement from BBC reporter Hugh Edwards on 9th September 2022, 2 weeks ago, that Queen Elizabeth II's 70-year reign had ended with her death at Balmoral in Scotland. For the next 10 extraordinary days, two operations ran into one another, Operation Unicorn and Operation London Bridge. London Bridge, as the code name for Elizabeth II's funeral, was one of the worst kept secrets in Britain. Operation Unicorn was one of the best. Operation Unicorn, based with its name on one of the heraldic beasts in the Scottish Royal Coat of Arms, was the contingency plan formed if Queen Elizabeth passed away in Scotland. And it saw some uniquely beautiful and moving imagery, not just of the absolutely breathtaking scenery in the east of Scotland and at its capital, Edinburgh, but of ceremony, ritual and sincere mourning, as the late Queen's body first lay in state not in Westminster, but at St Giles Kirk in Edinburgh. There, the Duke of Hamilton placed the crown of Scotland upon the coffin while it still remained in Edinburgh. There was a closing of a circle, the kind which history loves, in that since the Crown of Scotland had been commissioned by Elizabeth II's 12 times great-grandfather James V, who in 1542 was also the last monarch to die on Scottish soil until his 12 times great-granddaughter in 2022. I would say for this episode of Single Malt History, which will not begin or close with the usual jingle, there's no point in my rehashing of so many of the details of the 10 days that followed, in their precision, their splendour, those moving moments, the controversies that flared and dimmed towards the end, the crowds, the queue. In part, that is because I spent the 10 days commenting on it for some news outlets, the first of which was BBC Radio Ulster here in Northern Ireland, going to the royal family's official residence in Northern Ireland at Hillsborough Castle, on the first day of mourning with anchor Tara Mills and Ian Jeffers, former director of the Prince's Trust in Northern Ireland. Through to the last, which was 10 days later with Al Jazeera in London on the evening that the funeral had concluded. If I could here, this seems slightly redundant, or maybe not redundant, or insufficient, so thank you. To two bodies, I suppose. Some of those interviews are available elsewhere. If anyone, I can't imagine who would, but if anyone wants to listen to them, they are. Most of them are available online. Most of them were commentary on events that obviously were happening or were unfolding. I would very briefly like to extend my thanks to you for your patience as the podcast went into abeyance for the national period of mourning, and for the encouragement as I returned to it. and also to the networks who had me on to talk about the events of that period: Al Jazeera, the BBC in Northern Ireland, All England, Arabic, Berkshire, Gloucestershire, Herefordshire and Worcester, London, Oxford, Radio Foyle, Radio Ulster and West Midlands, Fox News, Fox and Friends, Good Day Atlanta, The Times of London, U105 and Us Weekly. I sincerely appreciate people taking the interest in current events and history, and for me it was fascinating as a historian to see it, but also the reason why, thanking both the listeners and the networks that had me, is that it's an honour to comment on history on the 10 days of national mourning for Elizabeth II, sharing the facts behind history and culture that underpinned those events was something I took seriously. From a local perspective, it was particularly moving to cover the mourning at Hillsborough Castle, also the accession proclamation of King Charles III, and the first visit of Charles III and Camilla as King and Queen to Northern Ireland, as well as the Queen's committal at Windsor Castle with the team at the BBC. It was an absolutely historic 10 days, and so from the bottom of my heart, thank you. Having covered those other events, I thought instead today to comment on two aspects. The first is to reflect, with time to reflect, on what we were seeing. I've read an opinion piece, and I agree with it, that the public's response to Elizabeth II's funeral was in many ways a great act of rebellion. It was a rebellion, a quiet but large rebellion, against what Britain is or what it has become. It was a kind of defiant gesture for what many wished it to be. I usually avoid, too obviously, a political bent here. There's enough of that on every corner of the internet. So what I will say is that I'm someone who's often equally exasperated by right and left. We have had a generation of Conservative Party government in Britain, in which I would argue that the new right or the neocon vision has proved increasingly dominant as the years have passed and with each new election cycle. Numerous budget cuts, countless government proposals in those years have been determined solely by cost. Is something cost effective? Can we measure or judge its technological or financial impact? And more specifically, can it be judged as worthy of elevation or praise by how much of a profit it turns, unambiguously? In many ways, the monarchy, and especially the state funeral, is a grand negation of that. And it felt like there was, among the crowds in London, certainly when I was there and what I was witnessing, there seemed to be a determined psychological rejection of that. Likewise, a rejection of the cult of the individual, or perhaps more specifically, the celebration of individualism, in the sense of putting the self first. It would also be obtuse to pretend that there were not intense displays of patriotism, including by many members of the Labour Party, rejecting the idea that patriotism is something rejected in Britain by supporters of otherwise left-wing views. So to me, in the long term, historically and culturally, what it tells us about how many people don't fit into what we're told to think of as right and left was very interesting. But we'd have to wait more long term to see what the historical validity of that suspicion is. The death of queens and kings, and particularly those 10 days, were for me days when history and modernity, past and present, seemed to flow into one another, as if time had somehow been suspended or upended. When delivering his eulogy on the death of Elizabeth II's father, King George VI, in 1952, Prime Minister Winston Churchill said it far better than I ever could with this, which I'd like to share with you. When the death of the King was announced to us yesterday morning, there struck a deep and solemn note in our lives, which, as it resounded far and wide, stilled the clatter and traffic of 20th century life in many lands and made countless millions of human beings pause and look around them. A new sense of values took, for the time being, possession of human minds, and mortal existence presented itself to so many at the same moment in its serenity and in its sorrow, in its splendour and in its pain, in its fortitude and in its suffering. course, I've written about other monarchies and royalties before, so I also thought I could share with you some interesting notes and developments on the guest list, which didn't always get picked up in mainstream media, and also thoughts on some of the historical inspirations we saw. To begin with, the funeral services were both inclusive of many faiths and communities, while being very clearly a Christian, specifically Anglican Protestant service. We saw extracts from the Book of Job, Revelation, and the Gospel according to St. John. It's also interesting that the funeral at Westminster Abbey contained a reading from the 1549 translation of the Book of Common Prayer, the first great official Protestant prayer book in English history, enacted by Elizabeth II's pious collateral ancestor Edward VI, England's first confirmed Protestant monarch. There are later versions and translations of the Book of Common Prayer, of course, so for the late Queen to have chosen the 1549 edition speaks to someone who, I think, preferred a more traditionalist form of worship in how she experienced and professed her Christian faith. The text, "Thou knowest, Lord, the secrets of our hearts, shut not thy merciful ear unto our prayer," was set to music by Henry Purcell, the great English composer who famously composed the music for the funeral of another ruling British queen, Mary II, in 1694. We also saw very traditional figures accompanying the coffin as it entered Westminster Abbey, including the Archbishops of Canterbury and York, the Most Reverend and Right Honourable Justin Welby and Stephen Cottrell respectively. They were joined by Sir Kenneth Olesa, High Bailiff of Westminster, and the Earl Marshal, the Duke of Norfolk. The Earl Marshal is a hereditary post. The Dukes of Norfolk have been organising royal coronations and funerals for centuries. Elizabeth II's coffin was followed by members of the royal family, and quite interestingly, this marked a first in British royal history by abandoning centuries of tradition in which gender superseded age. We saw that King Charles III's sister, Princess Anne, the Princess Royal, who had, we now know, spent the last 24 hours of Elizabeth II's life at her mother's bedside, processed after her brother, King Charles III, and Queen Camilla, ahead of her younger brothers Andrew and His Royal Highness Prince Edward, Earl of Forfar and Wessex. The hymns included "Love Divine, All Hope Excelling," "The Lord is My Shepherd," and of course, "The Day Thou Gavest, Lord, Has Ended," one of the most popular songs at British Christian funerals. It's certainly one that I would want at my own. And also a reading from "As the deer o'er the hart panteth for the water, so my soul longeth after thee." So from its opening ceremonies, the funeral balanced grand tradition with innovation. And this was a theme continued with the readings and prayers, as for the first time in British history, we heard readings at a royal funeral delivered by representatives of evangelical and charismatic Christian communities, including the reading from Miss Shamara Fletcher, representing the Pentecostal churches in England. There was also the first time a Catholic archbishop had prayed at the funeral of a monarch in Westminster Abbey since Queen Mary I's funeral in November 1558. This was a prayer read by His Eminence Cardinal Vincent Nicholls, Archbishop of Westminster. There was also participation from Cardinal Nicholls' counterpart in Ireland, His Grace Archbishop Eamon Martin, Roman Catholic Primate of Ireland. This was the first time in history, 1558 or otherwise, that an Irish primate or archbishop had participated in a British monarch's funeral. Archbishop Martin was initially anticipated to be joined by representatives of every major Christian denomination from Northern Ireland. However, at the last minute, Reverend Brown, representing the Free Presbyterian Church, declined to attend Monday's service, as to do so would have required him travelling on a Sunday to London, which he feels would be a violation of the Sabbath. However, Reverend Nixon, president of the Methodist Churches in Ireland, the Reverend Dr. John Kirkpatrick, Presbyterian moderator for Ireland, and His Grace Archbishop John McDowell, the Church of Ireland Primate and Metropolitan, were at Westminster Abbey for the service. There they were joined by many elected heads of state, notably including President Draupadi Murmu of India, President Joe Biden and First Lady Dr. Jill Biden of the United States of America, the presidents of Albania, Austria, Brazil, Cyprus, Finland, France, Germany, Greece, Israel, Italy, Kosovo, Latvia, Lithuania, Namibia, Mauritius, Poland, South Africa, South Korea, Switzerland, Trinidad and Tobago, and Turkey. You can imagine the sheer scale of the security operation mounted for Operation London Bridge. Some countries, like Sri Lanka, sent both their president as head of state and prime minister or prime ministerial equivalent as heads of government. The Republic of Ireland did likewise, with President Michael Higgins being joined by Taoiseach Micheál Martin, Taoiseach being the Irish government's equivalent, broad equivalent of prime minister. This was the first time an Irish president attended a British sovereign's laying to rest. And President Higgins and the First Lady of Ireland, Sabrina Higgins, had already attended the memorial service for Elizabeth II at St Anne's Cathedral in Belfast on the previous Tuesday. Who wasn't there? Well, Olena Zelenska, First Lady of Ukraine, did attend. Her husband obviously did not, staying in Ukraine to continue leading the war effort against Russia, who were not asked to send a representative, neither were the governments of Belarus and Myanmar. Some countries, like Iran and North Korea, were only asked to send ambassadorial representatives rather than governmental. There was also a Foreign Office faux pas. Allegedly, we're hearing a miswording in translation or text of the invitation issued to the Danish royal family, which led to them thinking there was space for two rather than three guests. In consequence, Crown Princess Mary of Denmark did not join her husband or mother-in-law in London for the funeral, although, as she made clear through a statement with the Danish Foreign Ministry, she had very much wanted to. I will be honest, I am slightly struggling to imagine. It's just quite frustrating to think that there could have been a faux pas on that scale from the Foreign Office. Just very embarrassing for the government, this government, not Denmark's, that the Crown Princess wasn't included. And it does seem to have been, obviously, a genuine oversight. And by the time it was corrected, travel plans had already been finalised, as had the Crown Princess's schedule in Denmark. But yes, I struggle to imagine. Mistakes always happen, of course they do. We have to have grace for mistakes, but that is quite a doozy in dealing with the future Queen Consort of Denmark and guests to the former head of state's funeral. Some monarchies like Kuwait, Liechtenstein and Morocco sent the heirs to their throne. Some of the more elderly monarchs had to decline attending Elizabeth II's funeral on health grounds. There were worries. I remember us trying to get confirmation for some of the broadcasts, really up to the last minute, almost up to the last minute, if not quite, that Elizabeth II's cousin and friend, King Harald V of Norway, would likewise be unable to attend. Norway's hugely popular 85-year-old monarch had been hospitalised this summer with an infection, but he was ultimately able to travel in good health to London with his wife, Queen Sonia. He joined His Majesty Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa, King of Bahrain, Their Majesties King Philippe and Queen Mathilde of the Belgians, His Majesty the Sultan of Brunei, the Queen of Denmark, who is now Europe's longest reigning monarch following Elizabeth II's passing, Their Imperial Majesties Emperor Naruhito and Empress Masako of Japan, Their Majesties King Abdullah II of Jordan, King Letzi III of Lesotho, Sultan Abdullah Al-Haj and Tunku Aziza Amina Maimuna Iskandaria of Malaysia, and Sultan Hatim bin Tariq of Oman. His Majesty King Carl XVI of Sweden, joined by his wife Queen Sylvia, was in attendance, as was His Majesty Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, the Emir of Qatar, and their Royal Highnesses Grand Duke Henri and Grand Duchess Maria Theresa of Luxembourg, along with the Prime Ministers of Australia, Bangladesh, Canada, New Zealand, and the Foreign Ministers of Chile, Colombia, Mexico, Nepal and Uruguay. The Lord Lieutenants, the British monarchy's historical representatives in the counties and regions across the United Kingdom were invited, as were numerous high commissioners, former prime ministers or heads of government for the Commonwealth nations. The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia did not attend, some say after public backlash. others that he has not set foot in Britain since the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. Among the royals that did attend, some interesting developments. There was quite a bit of controversy over the Spanish royal contingent. None regarding the attendance of the current monarch and his consort, King Philippe VI and Queen Letizia, but the Spanish government were openly unhappy at the decision by their former king, Juan Carlos, to go. He abdicated the Spanish throne after a series of financial and personal scandals, and the Spanish government felt it was inappropriate for him to attend, a decision which the King Emeritus, or ex-king, depending on your preferred nomenclature, ultimately ignored. He was joined by his wife, Queen Sophia, who is a Greek princess by birth. She is the daughter of the late Prince Philip, Duke of Edinburgh's cousin, King Paul. The Spanish royals sat together in the abbey, all four, immediately behind the Swedish and Dutch royal parties. Which brings us to the fact that Juan Carlos was not the only former sovereign there. The Dutch king, Willem Alexander, and his Argentinian wife, Queen Maxima, were joined by his mother, Princess, formerly Queen Beatrix, a lifelong close friend of Elizabeth II, like her, a child of the Second World War generation. In her mid-70s in 2013, Queen Beatrix abdicated in favour of her son, the current King Willem Alexander. Some of the royals at Westminster Abbey had already paid their own tributes to Elizabeth II, two of which I find especially interesting and moving. Some of you may have seen photographs of Denmark's Queen Margaret II struggling to hold back tears during the funeral. This was or is the Queen of Denmark's Golden Jubilee celebration year as her country's head of state. She succeeded her father, King Frederick IX, in 1972. But she scaled back some of the celebration, many of the celebrations, and introduced minutes of silence into some of the later festivities upon hearing of her friend Elizabeth II's death. These are some of Queen Margaret's thoughts on Elizabeth II, shared at the time, in happier times, of Elizabeth II's Platinum Jubilee earlier this year.
She was 26 when she became queen. That really made an impression, an enormous impression on me. The fact that that she was dedicating her life, it's what it's all about. That's the whole point of my life. And as I know she sees it too, that it's the whole point of her life. The way she has faced her duties, the way she is dedicated, but also that she does it with a smile. I think the tone of her voice is very, very special. It's a very clear and a very attractive voice to my mind, to my ear. And you can feel the humor through it. Yeah, there's no doubt that she has a marvelous sense of humor. She can look very serious, but one knows that underneath it. She's aware about everything that happens around her, and she can. I can't exactly point out a particular thing, but I do know that when something funny happens in the background, she will see it. I don't become a different personality. I hope. I feel that I'm the same sort of person underneath. She's also the same person inside, and knows very well that she is the same. Governments change. They should change. They must change. But the sovereign is there. You belong to your country. You don't belong to any section of it, or even any part of it. One belongs to one's whole nation. And I think that is one of the things that Queen Elizabeth does so beautifully. My heart really goes out to her. She's been through many things in her life, and now she's alone, and she's still bearing up beautifully. That really is most impressive.
Perhaps one of the more beautiful ceremonies of remembrance by guests had been those offered by Their Majesties King Jigme and Queen Jetsun of Bhutan. They had offered the service of 1,000 butter lamps, a Buddhist prayer service to offer light to the memory and soul of Elizabeth II. The ceremony was attended by the royal family in Bhutan, the Prime Minister, and thousands of Bhutanese citizens. The King of Bhutan said it was part of his faith in extending condolences to those mourning Elizabeth II, of whom he said he admired her tireless and selfless service to her people. Her Majesty will always be remembered for the wisdom, grace, dignity, and strength she personified. There were also quite a lot of the ex-majesties of Europe, the deposed royal families. Some were unsurprising guests, of course, given the fact that Elizabeth II's late husband was a member of the Greek royal family. The deposed Greek king, Constantine II, was at the funeral, joined by his Danish wife, Queen Anne Marie, who is Queen Margaret II of Denmark's sister. The ties between the British and Greek royal families run to friendship as well as familial, because King Constantine II is also the godfather of King Charles III's eldest son and heir, William, Prince of Wales. There were more affectionate ties over fallen crowns in the form of His Royal Highness Crown Prince Alexander of Serbia, the current claimant to the defunct Serbian throne. Before the country of Yugoslavia split into several different countries, the Serbian royal house had been the royal family of that region of what was Yugoslavia. The Yugoslavian royals have had close ties to the Windsors for decades. Prince Paul of Yugoslavia was a lifelong friend of the late Queen Mother. He went to Oxford with her brother, Michael Bowes-Lyon, and knew her from her time as a debutante in 1920s London. And during the Second World War, Britain had granted asylum to young King Peter II of Yugoslavia, although ultimately they could not save the Yugoslav monarchy when it was overthrown in favour of communism at the war's end. A similar fate hit the Bulgarian monarchy, with the last Tsar, Simeon II, being deposed as a child in a communist coup. The Bulgarian royal family hadn't done well with totalitarianism. Simeon's reign was ended by communism. His father, Tsar Boris III's life was ended by fascism when he was quite probably poisoned by Nazis after refusing to cooperate with pressure from Hitler to include Bulgarian Jews in the plans for the Holocaust. However, in a very strange fate, after communism collapsed in Bulgaria, Simeon II was allowed to return. A former palace was handed back to the Bulgarian royal family for use as a residence, and Simeon was then democratically elected Prime Minister of Bulgaria, serving from 2001 to 2005. Upon Elizabeth II's death, Tsar Simeon sent a personal message of condolence to dear Charles, saying, "I am completely devastated," and ending with the quite touching sign-off, "I hug you, Simeon." Co-host referred to this as the ultimate blast from the past when we were talking about it. His Imperial and Royal Highness, the Archduke Karl von Habsburg of Austria, was there. He is the grandson of the last reigning emperor of Austria, Karl I, who was deposed when the monarchy collapsed at the end of the First World War in 1918. The Windsors have had a particularly oddly close relationship with the Habsburgs, considering there's not really many family ties there. There is a previous episode called on this podcast called When the Windsors Saved the Habsburgs, or The Real King's Man, that narrates what I'm about to talk about. But after the Austrian monarchy collapsed, the Windsors, led by King George V, organised a secret spy mission to evacuate the Austrian royals in case they were murdered by revolutionaries. And that was just after the First World War. Just before the Second World War, they did the same thing again with the last emperor's widow and her young children when they were threatened by kidnapping by Hitler's agents after the Habsburgs refused to support the Anschluss between Germany and Austria. The British royals evacuated the widowed empress and her younger children to safety in Canada. However, there was quite a bit of controversy, allegedly, within some of the royal families in 1989, when the last emperor's widow, Zita of Bourbon-Parma, died after an extraordinarily long widowhood. She died in 1989. Her husband died in 1922. Zita was allowed by the Austrian Republic to have a quasi-state, we could call it official or grand funeral, whereby her body was processed with imperial honours through the streets of Vienna to be buried at the Habsburg dynastic crypt in the city centre, or very near it. And the Windsors did not send a representative to Zita's funeral, or at least there wasn't a firm enough recognition of a representative to the funeral of the last Empress of Austria, and some of the royal families allegedly made it known that they thought that was quite poor form. So I wonder if we're seeing the Greek, the Bulgarian, and the Serbian royal families there in a symbol of long-lasting friendship, and perhaps the Habsburgs being invited to avoid the alleged insult that was offered in 1989. It's just speculative, but I don't think the Habsburgs were expected to be invited, but Archduke Karl, the current head of the House of Habsburg, was there. All of this, I would say, is, to me anyway, fascinating culturally, historically, whatever one wants to call it. To move to the figure at the centre of this, Elizabeth II was the sovereign I was born under. The same is true of my mother. She is the only one that many of us, certainly in my family, have ever known. And I think she would want dearly to hear the words "God save the King" for her son for the first time since the death of her beloved father. You may have noticed that I have referred to Camilla as Queen Camilla or the Queen at several points in this. I know that at the moment they are still putting the word consort after some references to her. That has never been done with any queen consort in British history. My instinct would be that there was actually a slight delay after Queen Victoria's death before they began referring to her daughter-in-law Alexandra as the Queen. My instinct is that the consort will be phased out over time, and like every queen consort before her, she'll be referred to as Her Majesty the Queen, and sometimes as Queen Camilla. But there have been many tributes to the late Queen, to Elizabeth II. I myself have spoken elsewhere, many people have spoken elsewhere, and nearly all of their tributes are finer and better than anything I could conjure. I'm quite certain at the distance of a week I couldn't add very much more else here that is worthwhile to what I've already said or to what others have said. And I was trying to sort of figure out, what to say with this without being repetitive. And so I think the words I would want to read that I think summarize it all of how I'm feeling and how I felt are the words of the scripture in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 7. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. And to me, that is the perfect summation of Elizabeth II's reign, career, and impact. I shall play this episode out with one of the hymns from the funeral, the one I mentioned, "The Day Thou Gavest, Lord, Has Ended," the first and last verses of which read, "The day thou gavest, Lord, is ended. The darkness falls at thy behest. To thee our morning hymns ascended, thy praise shall sanctify our rest." And at the end, "So be it, Lord, thy throne shall never, like earth's proud empires, pass away. Thy kingdom stands and grows forever, till all thy creatures own thy sway." This will be played by some of the Highland bagpipers. Thank you for your time. Single Malt History will resume as normal.